Good morning and welcome to the Miller Center Forum. The tragedy at Virginia Tech on April 16th of 2007 has focused increased national attention on issues that are at the intersection of education and law and mental health and the criminal justice system. I think that all of us who teach at the college level each year have one or more students who exhibit many of the signs of being troubled at some level, and we wonder what to do, how to deal with these situations. Laws governing confidentiality place serious constraints on communications that you can engage in about troubled students. Mental health professionals struggle over what's the best way, the best time to intervene once mental health issues have been identified. And parents and other family members frequently are in the dark about those who need help, and those who need help frequently don't get it for any variety of reasons. So today we are bringing together three experts, each of whom views these issues through a somewhat different lens. Each speaker will open with about 20 minutes of discussion, and then we'll have time, about 20 minutes in each case, for Q&A. And then following each presentation, we'll take a very brief break so that our speakers can give a give a short summary at the very end. Our three speakers today, and I'll introduce each one in greater detail before they speak. Greg Satoff is a practicing psychiatrist who teaches at the University of Virginia and is one of the leading experts on the identification of school shooters. Allison Melman is an activist for improved mental health delivery services, particularly for the college-age population, and she views the issues as one whose brother committed suicide when he failed to get help as a college student. Richard Bonney, a law school professor, chairs the Virginia Commission on Mental Health Law Reform. Let me start by introducing Greg Satoff. Greg Satoff is an associate professor of research in psychiatric medicine at the University of Virginia School of Medicine. In 1996, he was appointed to a commission charged with developing a methodology to enable the FBI to better access non-governmental expertise during times of crisis. In this role, he consults with the Crisis Negotiation Unit and the National Center for the Analysis of Violent Crime. Greg is a principal author of The School Shooter, A Threat Assessment Perspective, which was prepared for the FBI and is actually available on the FBI's website. Miller Center regulars know Greg Satoff as the director of the Critical Incident Analysis Group, which is an international group of intelligence, defense, and security professionals who meet annually here in Charlottesville to discuss threats to security and reactions to those threats. For the past 2 years, the Miller Center has hosted the opening session of the SIAG meetings. This past April, we hosted the opening session on the threat of homegrown terrorists. Please welcome Greg Satoff.
Thank you very much, George and Governor, for asking me to speak at such a special place, the Miller Center. I'm particularly privileged to be with such a distinguished panel today. Now, this panel is addressing one of the most riveting issues that I've seen in Virginia in the last 25 years. It is riveting because it addresses some of the most fundamental aspects of justice, general welfare, and liberty for a group that has not always had a voice, the severely mentally ill. Although my experience with the FBI School Shooter Symposium and Monograph has been invaluable to me, for this panel I feel compelled to refer also to my work with that very, very small percentage of mentally ill who are also known to be violent. As I spoke this weekend with a brand new intern at the University Hospital this weekend, I was reminded of one of the first lessons that I received as an intern almost 25 years ago when I started at the university. And that lesson is that things are not always what they appear. I'll never forget arriving early one morning at the hospital ward, which was a locked psychiatric ward. And there to greet me were two staff members. They said, "You have a new patient, and his name is Mr. Jones. And Mr. Jones is going to be having a commitment hearing in about 4 hours, and we just wanted you to know that we don't think that he needs to be here." Well, now that was good news to me. I was a young intern. I had lots of patients already, and the prospect of having a healthy patient who had been mistakenly admitted and that I could discharge was not a problem but a solution. But as I walked down the hallway, another staff member mentioned to me, said, "You know, I'm not so sure about Mr. Jones. I think that there might be a problem. I can't put my finger on it, but something about Mr. Jones makes me worry." Well, I arrived on the ward, and at the day room, very nicely dressed, middle-aged man, as nicely dressed as anyone in this audience, came up to me and asked me my name, asked me to pronounce my name, asked me to spell my name, and then spoke about the fact that he had been hospitalized mistakenly. He had taken too many pills, but it was because he had misplaced his reading glasses. And because of that, had misread his pill bottle and had fainted. And when someone had come to the house, knocked on the door, they saw him lying on the floor, called the rescue squad. Now, Mr. Jones then proceeded to quote Madison and Jefferson, and he quoted these two founding fathers appropriately, as far as I was concerned. He provided me a story that really hung together. And as I went to the chart, I didn't find any more information that was really very helpful. He had no listed next of kin. He had no symptoms of mental illness that he reported. He denied that he had ever been psychiatrically hospitalized before. And so I really had very little to go on. I had really nothing to go on in terms of making any kind of case for this man being mentally ill, except for the fact that he had taken too many pills the night before. Well, I did something I don't usually do. I called the rescue squad, and they referred me to the young man who had actually picked up Mr. Jones the night before. They gave me his home number because his shift had ended, and so I called this young man at home and awakened him. And I said, "Do you recall picking up a man named Mr. Jones last night?" And he said, "Oh, yes. I'll never forget that. And doctor, if there was ever a guy who needed to be in your hospital, it's Mr. Jones." I said, "Tell me why." And he said, "Well, when we were in the ambulance, he woke up halfway to the hospital, and he started swearing. He was furious, furious that he was still alive. He was so angry that he had not been successful in taking his life." Well, I thanked the young man, let him get back to sleep, and went into the commitment hearing. And to the surprise of not only Mr. Jones, but I think some of my staff members, I forcefully argued for his commitment. And indeed, he was committed and was hospitalized for the next 3 weeks. It turns out Mr. Jones had a fairly significant history of depression, had actually been quite paranoid for the 3 weeks prior to the admission. Had a friend, had a son in the Northwest who he was estranged from, and actually had burned a number of bridges in the past year or so, which left him with the thought that he had no place to turn. He responded very well to medication, and he left the hospital happy. And I thought that this would be the last time that I would see Mr. Jones, until 4 years later, I was on the downtown mall here in this town, and I noticed a well-dressed man with a well-dressed woman. He asked the woman to just wait for him a moment. He came up to me, and he stood right in front of me, just as he had stood 4 years earlier, and he said, "Do you remember me?" And I said, "Yes, Mr. Jones." And he said, "I bet you don't remember our first conversation." And I said, "Yes, I do." I said, "We talked about Madison and Jefferson and also the fact that you felt you didn't need to be in the hospital and that it would be an outrage for you to have been committed against your will. He said, well, I need to tell you something, doctor. What I was thinking at the time I spoke with you that morning was that I was going to be getting out that morning, and I knew exactly where the butcher knife was in my kitchen that I would use to cut my throat. And I was furious with you because I felt you had no right to stand in my way of my decision to end my life. But he said, I'll have to tell you that the last 4 years have been extraordinary for me. I have reengaged in my relationship with my son, my ex-wife, I now have a relationship with and have remarried her, and the last 4 years have been the happiest of my life. And I just wanted to thank you and your staff. Well, he said, doctor, I was lost and I didn't know it. Well, I think it's important for us to know that 50% of patients who are psychotic don't acknowledge an illness oftentimes and don't have insight into the fact that they need treatment. So it's one thing to be lost, but it's another thing to be lost and not know it. I'll tell you, this was really a humbling experience for me because I remembered this patient very well, and that without that slender reed of information, that phone call with the rescue squad worker, this man and his family wouldn't have the reunion that they so justly deserved. In fact, the studies show that up to 60 to 70% of those who are involuntarily treated after the fact agree that, in fact, this was necessary, this was essential for them. So one way to understand the issues that face us is at the individual level, as I just mentioned. But there are also systems-level issues. There was a recent report of a survey done by Elizabeth McGarvey here at the University of Virginia, in which she surveyed stakeholders within the Commonwealth and found that there are some serious problems that face our mental health system today. A shortage of beds is one significant problem, shortage of beds in willing detention facilities, insufficient time for adequate evaluation, inconsistent interpretations of law by judges, and also a lack of direction and oversight. And by that lack of direction and oversight, I read that, based on my experience, not as a criticism of any certain leaders in mental health, but rather a lack of infrastructure, a lack of mental health infrastructure that has deteriorated over the years. Now, how did we get there? How did we get to the place that we're in? I think we have to go way back in time, far, far back, back at the very time that our rotunda and academical village was being built. It was a time of great optimism, both in education and also for the mentally ill. Did you know that right after the bricklayers and the masons and the carpenters finished the rotunda and the academical village, they got into their wagons and they went due west into Stanton, Virginia, and built another place, another institution, and that was an asylum, which became Western State Hospital. At the time, there was great stigma against the mentally ill, and this may well have represented a tipping point in which society felt compelled to do something better for a group that had not been well served. For those of you who have been lucky enough to be at Western State Hospital to see that that building that was built, you can see that no expense was spared. It's really an extraordinary edifice. And with the best of intentions, the first patient was admitted in July of 1828. It happens that he was a young man from the University of Virginia, and the diagnosis that he carried was hard study. Well, I guess final exams and exams were as difficult then as they are now, but in fact, it was probably appropriate that this was the first patient because the plan, the great plan, that asylums would be the answer. In fact, it was a much harder study than we could have imagined. And unfortunately, over the next 120 years, I think most would agree that the Commonwealth and that the country received a failing grade. These places became warehouses, places of shame, dumping grounds. And these were places where one staff member might be responsible for 200 people. We're talking about a very, very inadequate system. And so after World War II, a book was written, Shame of the States, by Albert Deutsch. This was a really significant book. It was an expose of the terrible conditions in U.S. mental hospitals. 1948 was the year that that book came out, and same year, 1948, Olivia de Havilland was nominated as Best Actress for a movie called The Snake Pit, which really opened the eyes of many Americans towards the conditions inside. If that wasn't enough, if people at that point didn't feel like it was time for a change, within a few years, we had a remarkable event, and that was the production of Thorazine. Now, here's an early advertisement for Thorazine. It says, when the patient lashes out against them, Thorazine quickly puts an end to his violent outburst. Well, this is what it looked like. And since that time, there have been lots and lots of medications that have been made that are designed to treat major mental illness with less side effects than Thorazine. There still are significant side effects that these medications can have, certainly, but there have been improvements, no doubt. We've had now the publication of the book, the movie, the medication. And by 1963, President Kennedy signed the Community Mental Health Centers Act. And once again, much like the mid-1820s, we had an era of optimism. The goal was to decrease the stigma on the mentally ill, bring them into the community. But unfortunately, just as what happened with the institutions, we had inadequate funding. Western State Hospital downsized from a number of 3,000 patients at its peak to currently standing at approximately 250 patients. They took that facility and they actually built a much smaller facility in order to house patients. And it's instructive to know that that facility, that beautiful place that was built in the mid-1820s, and by 1976 was turned into a medium security prison. Now, I was fortunate enough to serve as a psychiatric consultant in that prison, and I took University of Virginia medical students with me, and we actually met with and worked with prisoners who had once been patients in the same hospital. If we look at what was happening around the country, it was much the same. In the last decade of the 20th century, there were 400 prisons built. 400 prisons built. And at the same time, there were 40 psychiatric hospitals that were closed. What do we have here? We've got what some call trans-institutionalization, a very expensive shell game in which we've gone from state mental hospital to the street, now back to institutions, institutions that may even be less well, that certainly serve patients' needs less well than many of the hospitals. While state hospitalized patients plummeted in numbers from 600,000 to 70,000 by the mid-1990s, the prison population of mentally ill skyrocketed to almost 300,000. Did you know that the largest psychiatric facility in the United States is the Los Angeles County Jail? 3,400 mentally ill inmates. The second largest psychiatric facility in the United States is Rikers Island, New York, the prison in New York, with approximately 3,000 mentally ill inmates. So, let's go back. This asylum in Stanton, Virginia, built in 1828, which in 1976 became a prison, is now being turned into upscale condominiums. For those of you who know Stanton or who have driven down that road, I invite you to take a look at what they are doing to this facility. And I'm not critical of the idea of taking historic buildings and making good use of them. But I think it raises the question, what's our obligation to the mentally ill? Deinstitutionalization has really created a cascade of consequences. Certainly for the police, who now deal with the mentally ill daily, and we're talking about dealing with severely mentally ill, Most policemen that I know did not go into police work with the expectation that they would be dealing with people who had major mental illness. And so I think that most police forces can really be credited for doing some remarkable training in order to take that responsibility. A few more facts are, I think, important to note. And that has to do with this whole issue of mental illness and violence. Is there a relationship between mental illness and violence? The answer is yes. But in most cases, the mentally ill are more likely to be victims than perpetrators of violence. A recent study last year in 2006 of almost 1,500 schizophrenic patients showed us that while 20% of those, almost 20%, had been engaged in some type of violence, it was only 3.6% who had been engaged in serious violence. So that's 96.5% of seriously ill patients who do not engage in serious violence. We do know that untreated patients with severe mental illness have more potential for violence. And we also know, based on some outstanding work that Richard Bonney and his colleague John Monahan did some years back, that the combination of severe mental illness and substance abuse is very toxic when it comes to this whole issue of violence. So where are we now? If we look at CDC figures, we see that in a 10-year period, emergency room visits have gone up 56%. The Surgeon General recently stated that 2/3 of people with mental illness in the United States get no treatment at all. And although the nearby asylum was turned into a prison and now is being turned into condominiums, the rotunda, Mr. Jefferson's rotunda, is still the rotunda, designed to serve the needs of education, but now in a very different world. You know that more students are being admitted now into the University of Virginia and universities and colleges across the country who have special needs and are taking significant medications. This really presents new challenges for our universities. If we understand mental illness and the epidemiology, it makes sense that our colleges and universities would be faced with this challenge. Half of people diagnosed with depression actually had their first episode before the age of 20, and 75% of people diagnosed with schizophrenia were diagnosed between the ages of 15 and 25, and so this is a very vulnerable period. And when we look at Erickson's stages of development, we know that from the ages of 13 to 18, adolescents struggle with identity versus role confusion. This is an age where peer groups and loyalty are most important. After age of 18, from 18 to 34, young adulthood, the struggle is intimacy versus isolation, where students struggle, adolescents and young adults struggle with love relationships, which now become most significant. So for any of us who've had children, we know that these stages are critical. For someone who is struggling with major mental illness, these struggles are very, very difficult. One of the challenges is that one of the last parts of the brain to develop, the prefrontal cortex, which is responsible for planning and self-reflection, insight, is one of the last to develop. And so it puts not only students, but parents of students and colleges and universities in a very, very difficult position. We do know that suicide claims 1,100 college student lives per year, and that there are no ivory towers. The Ivy League schools have had significant problems, just as the community colleges have had. Systemic problems have been noted by students at these Ivy League schools. At one school, 80% of students claim to have been depressed during the past year, and 10% claim to have been suicidal in the last year, with 1 to 2 attempting suicide. As we look at the last year, there's been a great amount of light and heat generated regarding society's approach to the mentally ill and the interface of the mentally ill with society. And this does raise fundamental questions of justice, general welfare, and liberty for both society and those who are impacted by severe mental illness. In closing, I'd like to mention that it is fitting that this last Miller Center panel of the season is focusing on such a We the People issue. And as it happens, on this date in 1788, Virginia became the 10th state to ratify the U.S. Constitution. And my appreciation of the Miller Center and its fine work, as well as the upcoming presentations of the next two panelists, I'd like to close then by quoting James Madison, who said, "The advancement and diffusion of knowledge is the only guardian of true liberty." Thank you.
I'm going to go to the back of the room and will invite those who have questions for Dr. Satoff to join me in the back. And while I'm moving to the back, Greg, let me perhaps steer this in a little bit different direction, and that is to talk about the small number, but still very distressing number, of young people who become shooters. Virginia's had two incidents within the last several years of students who have become violent towards their fellow students. What is the pathology? What's going on with these people? And how do we identify it? And how do we determine when to intervene?
Well, those are such significant questions, and in order to try and answer those questions, soon after Columbine, the FBI put together a large symposium of experts from around the country, and we interviewed people who were administrators and teachers and survivors of school shootings that had occurred in the 10 years previously. 19 different schools were represented, including Columbine. And what we learned was, first and foremost, that there is no specific profile of a school shooter. There are many roads, unfortunately, that can lead to this type of destructive violence. What we did learn, though, is that there are social and personality and school-related factors that can influence decisions that these students make. Students who come from families where they don't have the kind of comfort in speaking with siblings and family members about their troubles and their struggles are certainly more likely and more at risk. But what we saw, George, was a real dynamic in which there were a number of different factors that seemed to enter in. Raising the threshold or lowering the threshold for school violence. Another thing that we know is that there is quite a copycat effect. Whenever the media reports on one of these stories, there is a reverberation in schools across the country, and that bomb threats and threats to shoot go way up. So certainly the influence of the media is very important and something that complicates the issue even further.
Following up on that, Greg, how should faculty members, friends of students, at what point should they become concerned? What are some of the warning signs that they ought to look for?
Well, certainly when students are marginalizing themselves with regard to the rest of their group. When students go away to school, it's very important for them to find a peer group and find some way to fit into this wholly new environment. Students who are having more difficulty doing that are ones that could end up requiring special help. And I think that colleges and universities are working harder to do that. One of the things that's important to remember, though, is that for a young person who is beginning to get the symptoms of major mental illness, it can be very insidious. I've had students who were top students at University of Virginia getting excellent grades and still having great problems as they more and more faced very significant and serious symptoms that worried them that they had difficulty with. One of the challenges, too, George, is that unlike high school, there are different rules, as Richard well knows, after someone turns 18. And so parents who expect the same type of communication with teachers that they had in high school are not only disappointed but often frustrated. And so it means that the university really shoulders even a greater responsibility in terms of the university community and making sure that students are plugged in and feel comfortable enough speaking about the difficulties that they're having.
You really answered my first question that I was going to ask you, but I'll think of another one. That is, we had an uncle at one time, and our family took care of him for years because he was schizophrenic, and eventually he came under the control of the Veterans Administration. And they sent him to a special home, sort of a foster home situation. And he thrived in that environment because, one, they made sure he had his pills, they made sure that he was in good shape, and he loved the family, and they loved him. Is this sort of thing the kind of thing that might be developed in order to help in cases of strong mental illnesses?
Well, that is a model that that can and has worked very well. There are programs in the country where people have really gotten the kind of help that they needed. And I need to make it very clear that I'm not advocating that we go back to the old days of the asylum, but that the promise really was not carried out for many, many, many of our mentally ill. That said, the freedoms that many mentally ill have gotten by going into much smaller supportive communities has been truly liberating. And the kind of example that you just gave gives us hope and I think allows us to raise the bar in terms of our expectations of what can be for more and more patients.
What problems are you facing with the Privacy Act? And in other words, is this putting boundaries around you're trying to help these people? You can only just ask and go just so far? Because I know at Virginia Tech, which I am a part of, that they knew that he had been released twice, and they still weren't able to do anything because he was over 18. I believe that's the case. But the Privacy Act, I find, almost impedes information that people should have. And I was wondering your thoughts on that.
Well, I've talked to colleagues here at the university who deal routinely with cases, particularly cases of mentally ill who are seen in emergency rooms. And their response is that the greatest impediment is a lack of understanding and knowledge of the Privacy Acts and HIPAA, for example, the Portability Act, that in fact there are means, there are mechanisms that can be used. It makes it, I think people are anxious about these kinds of issues and making sure that they can communicate. In cases where there is a compelling interest, there are avenues that are often available and sometimes not explored. I know that this is an issue that Richard is going to be in a much better position to speak to. It's an important one because if we have perceptions that we can't share information, if indeed we can share it, we may as well have laws that are preventing us from sharing that. So it's not only a matter of having the right laws, but having the best understanding about what the possibilities are in terms of making effective communication.
I wondered about the reduction in beds in the hospitals. You've certainly mentioned it as an issue, and at the same time, I've just completed a term serving on the long-term care work group for the Health Reform Commission, and there were some people there who feel that any hospital at all operated by the state is a violation of Olmstead. And again, it's a matter of interpreting laws, understanding their implications, knowing how to deal with the issues. But how do we get the public to a point where they will accept the reality of the hospital and actually fund it appropriately, because the funding is also an enormous issue.
Yes. Well, all one need do is to go to a typical emergency room in this state and wait and see the kind of periods of time that patients are kept waiting as they try and find a bed. And if it's difficult finding an adult acute care bed in this state, it's even that much more difficult finding beds for adolescents. So consumers, whether they be clients, patients, family members, are routinely frustrated just by what you mentioned. Now, this issue of hospital beds is really a significant one, because it's not a static situation. It's not that we need X number of beds. There certainly is a lack of willing beds, available beds, for people who need them. But a good argument could be made that if facilities in the community, just the kind of facility that you mentioned, are built and structured and staffed, that there will be not as great a need for the hospital beds. There's no question, though, that the system right now is not working. It's not close to being optimal. And I'll tell you, there's nothing much more frustrating than being in a situation where you've got a patient who has a desperate need to be hospitalized and finding no way to get them into an appropriate place. And sometimes you try and find the best possible place, which may really not meet the patient's needs.
This is rather a follow-on from that last point, and that is about the kind of services that are available in the community for people. My understanding is that the numbers of outpatient services have declined by 50%, that the number of that's for adults, and a similar figure is true for children and adolescents. So that even if an individual is taken into hospital with an ECO or a TDO, the fact is that he or she will have to wait, on average, a further 23 days before they get their first outpatient appointment or service follow-up from a CSB. Just in terms of your experience of evidence-based practice, can you say something about what you think the likely outcome is for those individuals in terms of the longer term?
Oh, can you imagine how discouraging it is to have a need and to be put on a long waiting list? Sometimes these needs are quite acute, particularly if you're somebody who's very ambivalent about whether or not you actually need the help. Someone who is quite paranoid, for example, may see this as a sign that it just is not for him. So I worry about the number of appointments that end up being missed because they haven't been given in a timely way. Certainly in terms of community services, it's very important to see about decreasing that long list, that long wait. For example, if you think about the students in college, a student in college who requires assessment, if he's only got 11 weeks in the school semester and he's got to wait 6 weeks before he can get evaluation, this could spell real trouble in terms of his success, his ability to function that semester. I'd like to make just one other point, and that really goes back to your question and to your question, and that is this whole issue of infrastructure. Now, being in Virginia for the last 25 years, I know that infrastructure, whether it's roads or other type of infrastructure, is not very palatable for the taxpayer to pay. It's hard to see immediate benefits from developing infrastructure, but when I see the survey results questioning the lack of oversight and direction, it makes me think that one of our problems, one of our concerns, is that of infrastructure. Being able to have some oversight in order to fast-track certain people for outpatient evaluation, for example. Right now, we don't have that infrastructure in place that effectively works. We have programs, and some programs are very good, but it can, if you're not careful, it can be like having so many boxes without the kind of communication pathways necessary. Medicaid, the kind of funding that we have, tends more to fund specific services rather than the kind of infrastructure that we so desperately need.
Let us thank Greg Satoff, and we will take a very short break and then come back with Allison Melman. It is a great pleasure to introduce an outstanding young woman, Allison Melman. Allison is founder and executive director of Active Minds Incorporated, which is the only national student-run mental health awareness organization that's specifically targeted for college students. Allison is a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of the University of Pennsylvania, where she was a varsity cheerleader. She's now, of course, a cheerleader for the cause of mental health. In her spare time, this is fascinating to me, how people spend their spare time. Allison is a flyer. Not airplanes, not gliders, not hot air balloons on the trapeze. She teaches the flying trapeze at the Trapeze School in Baltimore, Maryland. She founded Active Minds a year after her only sibling, Brian, who was a student at Columbia University, committed suicide. Allison was convinced that stigma and the lack of information kept Brian from seeking help at a time when it might have made a difference for him. She vowed that this should not happen to anyone else, and the past few years has poured her talent and energy into working with college-age students. Please join me in welcoming Allison Melman.
I guess I'll open by telling you that Trapeze School is open to anybody who's interested in learning to fly, and I'd be happy to answer questions about that after the presentation. I am so pleased to be here, and I thank you all for coming. I want to open by telling you a story as well, and it is the story of my brother Brian, and I think it's an important story to tell because we often talk about college student mental health. In the news, we hear about incidents at Virginia Tech. We hear about student suicides, but we rarely hear about the life of the student who died. And when talking about these issues, we have to understand that these are real young adults who have aspirations and dreams, oftentimes are extremely successful in high school and in college. And for reasons that we're still not quite sure why, most serious mental illnesses, mental health issues, in general, first present in the high school and the college age. And it's a scary time for young adults, it's a scary time for students, and as we know, college students are on their own for the first time, so it's often up to their own volition that they acknowledge any signs. But at the same time, peers and friends are often in contact with students much more closely than parents and other adults. And we have a strong responsibility to educate all young adults so that they understand what to look for in themselves, what to look for in their friends, and then to know what to do once you notice signs. Story of my brother Brian. Brian and I grew up together in Potomac, Maryland, in Montgomery County, Maryland. We went to Winston Churchill High School, one of the top schools in Montgomery County, Maryland. Brian was the announcer for the Churchill football games. He was on the debate team. He was in our annual rock and roll revival show, Blast from the Past. Extremely successful student at Churchill. He got into his first choice school, which was Columbia. Went up to Columbia. His freshman year at Columbia was my freshman year at Churchill. We were 4 years apart. He joined an a cappella group in his first week there. He started writing for the school newspaper, The Spectator, while he was there. Brian had a strong interest in law, but after spending a summer at a law firm in D.C. in college, decided he didn't have a strong interest in law anymore and instead wanted to go into journalism and wanted to one day be the next Tony Kornheiser, very interested in sports writing and in humor writing. He was an incredibly, incredibly quick wit, very funny guy. In February of his freshman year at Columbia, Brian started experiencing what we now know as schizoaffective disorder, which was a combination of depression and some mania affiliated with bipolar disorder and depression and psychosis. It's often affiliated with schizophrenia. And in Brian's case, it caused him to sleep through classes for weeks at a time. But he told us, his family, that he had mono, which was a big thing, and students were getting mono all the time and sleeping through classes. So he missed classes. He often heard voices. Sorry. He was hearing voices, and fortunately the voices were not dangerous. He didn't cause any harm to himself or others, but some of the voices caused him to walk the streets of New York at night. For those of you who know Columbia's campus, he would walk up and down the steps of Lowe Library many times during a night because the voices told him to. He did all of this in secret. He did all of this in silence because he was ashamed. He had been a successful student. My mother was a social worker, so she was very keen on knowing about what was going on in her children's life. And my brother really wanted to be taking care of himself. He didn't understand what he was going through. He didn't understand what these symptoms were. And he wanted to be able to graduate. He wanted to be able to be that next Tony Kornheiser or lawyer or whatever he aspired to be. Didn't understand that what he was experiencing was symptoms of a mental illness and that you can get help. Help is readily available, and with help you can recover and you can live that successful life. For those of us growing up, oftentimes the only people we see with mental illness are those crazy people on the streets or the people who are perpetrating violence that we see in the media. What we don't see is the vast majority of Americans who are living successfully with any range of mental illness. There's no positive role models out there. There is nobody on Columbia's campus saying, hey, I'm a student here, I'm a professor here, I have bipolar disorder, I have depression, but look at me, I'm successful. Mental illness is not a life sentence. So Brian started experiencing this in his freshman year and hid it all from us, his family. But his friends did notice changes in him. He would show up at rehearsals, we later learned, and would kind of curl up in a ball in the back corner of a rehearsal. Brian was normally a very outgoing, funny guy, and this was obviously behavior that was not normal for him, but his friends didn't know what was going on. They didn't know what their place was. They didn't think it was their place at all to say something. They didn't understand what this was all about, and that they had a role as peers to help a friend into treatment. He finally sought help from Columbia's counseling center in November in his senior year. So it was 3 years after dealing with all of this on campus. And the therapist he saw recommended that he come home for the weekend to kind of relax. He had just kind of let them into his world, but it was around midterms. He was stressed out. He was anxious, and he came home. At that point, he started seeing a psychiatrist at home, and that's when we learned that he had been living with this for so long. And he stayed in intensive psychiatric treatment for the remainder of his life, for about a year and a half, in cocktails of different medications, in talk therapy. But at that point, the point that he had sought help, fortunately for us, he sought help, and that's a time that many young adults will take their own lives. Brian did seek help, so we did learn what he was going through, but he had really spiraled down to a point where there was no hope anymore. And he, a few weeks before he died, told my mother that he didn't want to be working at McDonald's for the rest of his life. That's all he could see of his life. He had lived for 4 years in isolation. These are very debilitating, isolating diseases, depression especially. Not having role models, not having anybody he felt comfortable talking to, he felt like he was the only one. So he ended up taking his life in March of 2000. Brian, he was 22 when he died. I was a freshman at Penn. I was kind of thrown into this as, you know, a new freshman on campus. It was around the same time that Brian had first experienced his illness when he was at Columbia. You hear about all of these, you can't really understand what it's like until you're there. But what I did see was that I was terrified, and I was terrified because Brian and I are extremely similar people, and I knew with the lack of education and the lack of dialogue that was going on my campus, I would have kept everything as silent as he did. And I would have gone through 3 years of school quiet, not wanting anybody to know, not wanting my mother to know, wanting to take care of myself. And something like that could have very well happened to me. And on a campus like Columbia, a campus like Penn, a campus like UVA, campuses around the country, no matter what tier it is, students are living in silence with these issues all the time, as we've learned with the incident at Virginia Tech. I want to open with this story mostly because I wanted to prove to everybody and to kind of reinforce what Dr. Satoff said, is that people with mental health disorders are far more likely to be violent to themselves or to be recipients of violence than they are perpetrators of violence to other people. And I think especially in the wake of the incident of Virginia Tech, I've had numerous parents come to me and scholars come to me and say, how do I make sure that my child isn't going to be the victim of something like this? And I'm here to tell you that, not to scare you, but the chances of somebody being a victim of an incident like at Virginia Tech is so much more slim than somebody showing risk to himself or others. Dr. Satov quoted a statistic from a top-tier university that said that 80% of students reported feeling depressed. There was actually a study that was done of all college students, representative of all college students last year, that said that nearly half of all students reported having felt so depressed in the past year that they could not function. That's college students around the country. 10% have reported seriously contemplated suicide, and 1 to 2% had attempted suicide. So that's a statistic that's not just limited to the top-tier universities. And while you can debate the merits of the study and what is depressed to the point of could not function, even if that's not serious depression, that's an issue that students are feeling, and they're feeling as though they can't go on with a class or they can't go on for one reason or another. My brother Brian continued to be a very successful student at Columbia before taking his leave of absence in his senior year. He had a 3.8 GPA. He had become president of his a cappella group. He had become sports editor of and columnist for the paper. He was a very successful student, as we typically define success. And many universities, really the only safety net they have in place to catch students who may be at risk is at academics and through noticing if grades deteriorate. And that often is a sign for many students, but it's also not a sign for everybody. So it's important to look for all of the signs in students who may be at risk. As we talk about in the wake of the incident at Virginia Tech, how do we make sure that this doesn't happen to our child? How do we make sure that our child isn't a victim? I think in following up with the notion that students are more likely to be violent and or harmful to themselves than others, it's an issue of opening lines of communication. And there are a lot of policies, FERPA and HIPAA, that sometimes are protecting the confidentiality of a student. And I know it's easy to jump to the conclusion that parents need to know everything at all times. Parents are oftentimes not the best people to know everything at all times, and it's hard to see that from the parents' perspective, but I've worked with quite a few students in the past 5 or 6 years for whom parents are one of the reasons that they're struggling with what they're struggling with. And parents are not always the people for students to be sent back to. If you are a parent with a good relationship with your child or family member, open lines of communication. The more lines of communication that can be open, the more willing, the more ready your student may be to say, hey, mom, I started seeing a psychiatrist here at school, or hey, mom, I'm really not feeling well. What do I do? Even though my mother was a social worker, and this is no fault of her own, we never really had much of that dialogue going on in my family because we never really felt like we needed it. And because this is an age that so many issues first present, even if we feel like we don't need the dialogue yet, it's always something that can be helpful. And what I've learned through working with Active Minds, the organization that I founded after Brian died, is that the more lines of communication that can be open, the more dialogue we have, the more likely people are willing to come forward with an issue once it presents. It doesn't have to be presenting right in front of us right now, but this is an issue that affects 1 in 5, 1 in 4 Americans at any given time, any range of mental health issues. We treat it as though it's an us versus them thing. And when talking about college students, we're talking about young adults who have these dreams and aspirations. They need to understand that this is an age that even if you aren't diagnosed with a clinical depression, you're going to get stressed out during final exams. You may find yourself eating less and wanting to look like the other sorority girls or the other girls on your team. Many mental health issues first present at the college age, and students need to understand that this happens and that there's treatment available. And even if you don't need professional treatment, learn how to relieve stress during final exams. Get a massage. Go and take an afternoon off and just sit out in the sun. We're so wrapped up in trying to get everything done and trying to be so productive that we often lose sight of what actually takes to take care of ourselves. What we've been doing since Brian died, I founded an organization that's really based on the premise of students educating students about issues of mental health. And that's done for a variety of reasons. One is that because there is so much of a stigma around these issues, it's often intimidating to hear from somebody from the counseling center, somebody from the health center, a parent, about depression or about bipolar disorder. It's very stigmatizing. It's very... No student really wants to listen to that. But if we have students standing up and say, hey, I lost a brother to suicide, or hey, I had an eating disorder in college, or hey, I have bipolar disorder now, other students feel much more comfortable confronting their own issues and telling their own stories. And the more stories that can be told, the more comfortable it can be. And people like my brother Brian can understand that they're not the only person on campus who's dealing with this, and that you can get help and feel better. The other reason is that students will work for free, and they have a lot of energy, and they have a lot of stories to tell, and they're very passionate about this cause. And I have found that in my work with students, we have grown from a chapter of a student group at Penn when I was there to now 69 chapters around the country. And all of those chapters have been started by students who have found out about our program and said, I want to bring this to my campus. I have a story to tell. What do I do? And it's been facilitated by staff in the counseling center, by faculty. But it's the student voice and the student energy that really drives what we do in a grassroots movement. I think there's a lot to be said about the level of stigma in our community. And I often tell a story right after my brother died, the weekend he died, his friends came home from college, my friends came home from college, and they sat with me. And they said, Allison, I have no idea what you're going through, but we want to sit with you. We want to sit here in silence with you. If there's anything we can do for you, please let us know. My mother's friends kind of abandoned her to the level where she actually lost a lot of friends after he died, and it wasn't, I don't think, despite her. It was because they didn't know what to say, but instead of being willing and open to sit and talk with her, they just kind of left. It was too shameful. It was too scary for them. And I think there's a generation gap in the way that we're approaching issues of mental health. My generation, generations behind me, have grown up with Prozac advertised on television. And even though we don't really understand what it's all about, we know it's there. And we're talking about it, and we're talking about it online, and we're talking about what medications we may be on or what our family experiences may be, much more so, I believe, than the older generation. And so it's going to take this generation to really make a sea change as we grow up and educate our children, become policymakers, become practitioners, become parents. We will implement a sea change of stigma reduction, and it really starts working with college students. These college students have so much energy, and they have the stories to tell. Oftentimes, as Dr. Satov referred, we have more students that are coming onto campus now with more serious mental illnesses, special needs, and that's because many more students are being diagnosed with mental health issues before they even get to college, which is great because many of them wouldn't have been able to get to college at all. They would have dropped out of high school and not gone on to higher ed. And now we have young adults who are coming on with more serious mental illnesses. That's causing counseling centers around the country to be having to reframe their work and reframe the constituency that they serve. And we've seen a trend in the past many years of the overburdening and underfunding of counseling centers on college and university campuses. It's often, we talked about the waiting list. I don't know of a single school where a student calls for an intake appointment and he or she gets an appointment the next day. The least amount of waiting I've heard is 3 weeks. And depending on, at a small university, when there's one counselor who's addressing the mental health needs of the entire college, it can be 3, 4, 5 weeks, up to 6, 7 weeks. And that is a half a semester. And in a college student's world, that's it. You cannot wait that long. And so there are more and more students who may be seeking help, but university policies have not adapted appropriately to offer the correct amount of resources to the counseling center. But it's also something that we can take a step back and look at and say, all right, if we're not going to get the money in the counseling center, this should be a campus-wide approach. This is not something, mental health issues are not something that are limited to the counseling center. Treatment of serious mental illness, absolutely. Professors should not be treating anybody with serious mental illness. But let the counseling center do the clinical work. Let students do outreach. Let professors be educated about different signs and symptoms to look for in their students and to know who to call for appropriate treatment. There's often a health center that may be available, a women's center, depending on the size of the university. The mental health of a student impacts his or her ability to graduate, impacts his or her ability to be an alumnus and donate funds. We need to make sure that our students are graduating, to break it down and into that level. When I was at Penn, there were 6 suicides on my campus in the 4 years that I was there. Those are 6 people who are not going to be donors. Brian is not going to be a donor to Columbia University. breaking down to that minimal level, we need to take care of the health and the mental health of our students just as much as we need to take care of their academic needs. The incidence of suicide, as we heard, suicide takes the life of 1,100 students on campus each year, thereabouts. We don't really know. I think that's an underestimate because suicide is often underreported. It is the second leading cause of death for college students, just behind accidents, and accidents really encompasses everything. It's a huge issue the students are willing to face, and the students are willing to address it, and we need to make this environment comfortable so that students do. When we look at the incident at Virginia Tech, and I'll close with this, we saw in the interviews Mr. Cho's roommates talking about how they knew he was a little bit off, and they knew that things were weird, and sometimes they'd ask him to go out with them, and then they just left him alone. They clearly saw changes in him. They clearly saw that he was a student that they were concerned about, that they weren't really comfortable living with. We need proper lines of education so that they would know exactly who to go to at that point to say, hey, you know, this is weird. We need to look into this. With an incident like my brother, if any one of his friends would have known to take his hand and say, Brian, I'm going to walk you over to the counseling center, who knows if something would have changed today. Students are seeing these changes in their friends. They're seeing it much more so. As we know, it's much easier to identify a change in others than oneself. We are the main lines of defense. Young adults are seeing each other change much more frequently. That education needs to go everywhere. Who knows if an incident like Virginia Tech would, you know, if this is the final episode or if there's going to be another one, but if it opens the lines of communication about campus mental health issues, then it's something that's good, and we can use this to move forward to make sure that all campus mental health issues are properly addressed in the future. All right, thank you.
Allison, as I move to the back of the room to take questions, and I encourage those of you who have questions to join me in the back of the room, let me ask what you would have folks here who maybe have a child or a grandchild who's at an institution, a college, that does not have an Active Minds chapter, what should they do? How do they get in touch with you, and then what happens? What do you do once you understand that College X would like to have an Active Minds chapter? Could you walk us through that?
Sure. It's a very easy process. First thing I would tell you to do is visit our website, which is activeminds.org. I have staff in my office who are chapters coordinators, and their job is to 24/7 be technical support for all interested parties in starting new chapters and our existing chapters. On the website, you'll find their email address. It's just chapters@activeminds or activemindsoncampus.org. You email them, they will send you a toolkit, which is a 3-ring binder of information that details Active Minds' mission, sample calendar of events, affiliations and programs that we've worked with and you have access to as a student or student group. And it also walks through the process of becoming a registered student group on campus. All Active Minds chapters become affiliated with the Student Activities Council so that they're officially affiliated with the university. So they go through the paperwork to become a student group on campus, and then we have the personnel in the office to help the programming throughout the course of the year. So check out the website and just email us, and we're there to help at any point.
Allison, I have a twofold question. What is the optimum number of counselors per 1,000 students in a university setting? And also, what kind of salary does a counselor in a university setting have to have to compete with people who are in private practice in the community?
I'll answer as best as I can. To the first question, what's the optimal number of counselors? The answer is we don't really know. The average is about one counselor to every 1,300 to 1,500 students. If we don't know if that's optimal or what the number is. And unfortunately, we have no way to really be able to assess that, or nobody has assessed it yet. And I don't know exactly the salary, matching of salary. I don't know if anybody else would have that kind of information, but I'm not familiar with that, so I don't know.
Allison, first part, so maybe this has already been discussed. But I have a question about, well, again, it's probably two questions. One, the young children today being diagnosed in grade school and put on Ritalin and whatever other drugs out there in the first, second, and third grades. My question there is, what has happened, certainly when I was in school, if that wasn't warranted as far as I know. And I had went to Catholic schools, and in two classes I was one of 72 and 76 children with one nun. And so nobody, we weren't on Ritalin then. The other is, the cause, is it the pressure that students and young people and all of us are living under today, or is this just being more discovered today, or were there this many suicides? I always remembered hearing in the early, 20s, 30s, if a boy didn't get in a fraternity at the university, he'd jump out a window and kill himself. I'm sure that was few and far between, or was it, and we just didn't know it? Thank you.
Sure. I'll answer the second question first. The cause and or the increased incidence of mental health issues on campus, we don't know. We think it's a combination of all of the factors, that there's more dialogue about it now so that there are more people coming forward with issues. As it is, suicide and mental health issues have become a hot topic in the past, I would say, 5 or 10 years. So there's more dialogue about it in general. Suicide especially, often in the past, if somebody would take his or her own life, family, the community would never talk about that person or of that person again. It was a shameful act. There are more people who are coming forward and acknowledging that they're suicide survivors. I'm not embarrassed to tell you that my brother took his own life, and I'd be happy to tell you about his life, but that's something that's very unique, and it's becoming less and less unique now. So there's more dialogue about it. There are increased pressures on college students today than there were in the past. There's also a biological component of mental health issues presenting at this age. We don't really know what's causing the more incidents. We do know there's more dialogue, and it may purely be a case of more people discussing it so that more people are seeking help for it. There's a lot of theories about 9/11 and increased financial burdens and increased family pressures. We don't really know. There's really no way. It's kind of comparing apples and oranges. But the first question, addressing more young people being diagnosed and being put on Ritalin, I can't really address the incidence of ADHD and ADD in elementary school students, but I do know that there are quite a few elementary school, middle school, high school students that I've heard of who take their own lives. I've heard of somebody, a young girl as early as the age of 8, who took her own life. And so as much as we can talk about the over-prescription of drugs for young people, it's an issue that really does affect young people too. We can't lose sight of the fact that young people are suffering maybe as much as their older counterparts. So it's really, we really need to take a look at it on a case-by-case basis. And see what is the problem that we are facing in the younger population.
First, thank you for being here and all the work that you're doing on a national level. I have two questions. One is, given the stigma that we've been talking about is very well and alive within various communities of color. In fact, many of us would say it's taken to another level. One, what might be you doing on a national level to remove some of the barriers that exist at predominantly white institutions so that more students of color are joining and connecting with organizations like yours, because it is a challenge? That's one. And then two, given that it is a very strong stigma, what might you be doing at either historically black colleges and universities, tribal colleges, or Hispanic-serving institutions to bring your organization there and begin to make some inroads?
Second question first. Again, we actually do have a couple of chapters at HBCUs that are specifically addressing the minority population and African American population. When we have our student groups on our campuses, they are predominantly white females who are running the groups. And a lot of our chapters have run panel discussions, and when I was at Penn, we ran a panel discussion that was entitled Mental Health Issues in the African American Community. And we partnered with Alpha Phi Alpha, which is a historically black fraternity on our campus, and we worked with them to have that kind of panel. So our chapters are working in that realm to connect minority students with mental health issues. But you're absolutely right. The stigma is as it is in society, and at any of the, you know, many cultures, many international students, minority students face their own level of stigma. And so we take our toolkit and our model and try to adapt it as well as possible to the other groups. There's also a conference that's being held in November in Baltimore, and I'm forgetting who's actually hosting it, but it's about suicide and mental health issues in the African-American college population. And we've been working with them to submit a proposal to do a presentation there as well.
As a local school board representative in a public educational system, I was just wondering if your organization has begun to reach out at all to K through 12 school systems, or any suggestions that you might have, because certainly the issues that we are dealing with in our college campuses are unfortunately alive and well in our high schools and middle schools as well. So,
I actually worked with a group in Maryland to pass a teen suicide prevention bill in the state of Maryland in 2005, and it was calling for the implementation of peer-to-peer awareness programs in addition to screening programs in Maryland high schools and juvenile facilities. And it passed unanimously and was signed into law, but MSDE has kind of dragged their heels in implementing anything. So it's been now 2 years where nothing has been implemented as a result of the bill. But you're absolutely right. These issues are not confined to colleges. It's easier to work with college students because they are over the age of 18, and because any student can start any type of student group that he or she wants as long as it's not replicating another group on campus. When talking about the few, I've tried to work with high schools, I'll say this as diplomatically as I can. In order to implement a program into a high school or middle school, it has to get the principal or superintendent, somebody's approval. And these issues are such that unless there's been a suicide or string of suicides at a school, the principal does not want to address it because it's not a problem. Because if they acknowledge that there may be mental health issues among their students, then all of their parents think that they're sending their kid to the crazy school and they want to take their kids out. Even after my brother died, we tried to implement programs at Churchill, and they wanted nothing to do with it. So we've had a hard time. That said, there have been quite a few independent schools where a principal has been a staunch supporter, and we've been able to work with them. I've done a lot of work in Montgomery County, Maryland, to do depression awareness days at school. It's been much easier to go on a school-by-school basis for us than it has been kind of an entire county. Though being part of, you know, that overarching group, we would love to expand our work into the high schools, and we do have two chapters now that are starting in high schools, but the students who have worked to start them, it's taken a year for them to get the approval that they need from the appropriate people. So,
I feel more optimistic about the future of civilization after having listened to Allison Melman. Please thank Allison, and we'll take about a two-minute break. It's a personal pleasure to introduce Richard Bonney, who I have known for, I hate to say this, 40 years. Richard graduated from the University of Virginia Law School the year after I did. It pains me to think that Richard is younger than I am. In the early 1970s, Richard Bonney was associate director of the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse, working with psychiatrists, and became interested in the issues surrounding treatment for addiction, for issues of confidentiality, and the use of coercion. Over the years, Richard Bonney has taught at the law school and has become one of the most knowledgeable voices on mental health issues in the criminal justice system. Currently, Professor Bonney is serving as chair of the Commission on Mental Health Reform, which was established by the Virginia Supreme Court. The goal of that commission is to suggest reforms that will help people with mental health problems get the help they need when they need it, so the mental health crises can be prevented or ameliorated, and so that suffering and injury can be avoided. Please welcome Richard Bonney.
Thank you, George. You don't have to believe that I'm younger than he is. May not be true. So Greg gave us a wonderful historical context for what I'm going to talk to you about. And I think the bottom line is as clear from what he said, and I think from what many of you have said in the intervening session, is that this is about the unfinished business of deinstitutionalization. And we just have to redouble our efforts to do something about that. So that, I think, is the kind of beginning point for what I want to talk about. From Allison, I think we got sort of the narrative, obviously, of her own experience and her brother's case, which provides a rich individual context for the issues that we're talking about. And she talks a lot about the implications for students and their families, peers, college administrators, I mean other people in terms of how to respond on an individual level. But of course, she's also trying to have an impact on the development of policy, which is where I'm going to come in here. So I really want to think about the policy implications of the problems than we have heard about here, and what might some of the solutions be. There are two large issues, I think, here. One is the overall challenge for mental health policy. And I'll just re-quote the phrase that George just mentioned, because I think it does say what our challenge is. We need to learn how to design these systems so that people with mental health problems, whatever their age, can get the help they need in their communities when they need it, to prevent crises or to ameliorate crises as they develop, and thereby prevent the suffering and harm that we are all too aware of. And this has to be done in all settings. I've been focusing the work that we've been doing on the community at large and in the public mental health services system, but you know, obviously the problems that we're talking about here arise in other institutional contexts, and particularly, as we've been discussing, in school settings, both primary and secondary schools, as well as in colleges and universities. And the goal in all these situations is to provide timely access to high-quality services that are delivered in a climate of caring, trust, and respect, and without stigmatization, right? Now, I think we can all agree that that's really what our ultimate objective is. The second issue is what role the law can play in this effort. And so I just want to mention, since we haven't, it's come up a bit in what we've talked about, and I want to sort of dig a little bit more deeply into it. But, you know, clearly we want the law to be assisting in this effort and not to be an impediment. And I think quite often now, I mean, sometimes the law is of assistance. I don't want to ignore the cases in which interventions occur because the law was available to help that happen. But I think all too often, frankly, the law is an impediment. And so the challenge of mental health reform is to try to accomplish this vision, which requires at the beginning an investment in services, but also to reframe and develop a blueprint for where the law can actually help implement these goals. So here are some principles that are guiding the work of the Commission on Mental Health Law Reform. The first point is that the best way to achieve the vision of the kind of services system that I mentioned that is accessible to people and provides the help when they need it, is that we need to emphasize voluntariness and self-determination in this process. We need to basically create a services system that draws people into treatment because treatment is regarded as desirable and not stigmatizing. And that it does occur in the climate of trust that I mentioned. All right, so the point, we hear a lot about coercion whenever anything tragic happens. But the point that I want to emphasize here is that more coercion is not the best path to safety and security. Right? I mean, we have to create the services. I keep emphasizing the important thing is to create the services. But the services should be the kind of services that draw people into them rather than away from treatment. Right? And in all the work that I've been doing, particularly in the public services sector, we just hear repeatedly about people who do not have access to the system, A, because, you know, again, I just want to keep emphasizing there's a problem here of access to care because we don't provide the resources. But even in the context in which the services are now available, people don't take advantage of them because they feel stigmatized and because they regard the system as unduly coercive. All right. So this is a very important point, that voluntariness has got to be the guiding principle, and emphasizing empowerment for people and giving them some measure of control over the services that they receive. Second point is that sometimes coercion is needed. And it should be used, of course, when it's necessary. One of the problems that we have in the system as it is now designed is that it's not used sometimes when it's necessary, and it's not available expeditiously when it's necessary, and sometimes it's not used effectively when it's necessary. Right? So we have you've got the worst of both worlds here, in the sense that the system is not drawing people in. Okay, attracting people with a services that attract them, and maybe driving people away from services. And again, this is a societal context that I keep mentioning in terms of stigmatization and so on. But also, even when we try to use the law to assist, we don't do a very good job of it in many cases. And the cost, as we know, of failing to intervene can be very high. So we need to find a better way of removing impediments to using the law expeditiously and effectively. Okay, so that's the second point. Now, you may say, well, there's a tension, in the two points that you've just made, right? We want to try to promote voluntariness, but coercion is sometimes necessary. So how do we know exactly when it's necessary? And if we try to err in the direction of promoting coercive intervention because we don't want to make mistakes, aren't we going to really compromise the principle of voluntariness? So this is a conundrum, right? And it's the basic challenge, I think, in terms of the design of mental health legislation. But I do think we can actually resolve this tension. And the way forward in doing this is to maximize respect for choice and for dignity of the individual, even when coercion is being used, right? This is not a question of a binary choice between, having coercion and then basically taking the view that, well, you obviously were not in a position to make your own judgments, so we're going to take over and make them for you. And in a kind of a, just in the extreme form, an authoritarian sort of a way, right? Versus everyone that is allowed to, in whose lives we're not going to intervene and are going to be left, to make their decisions on their own and promote voluntariness. Now, a basic idea here is this is a continuum. This does not need to be a binary system. And so on the side, in the cases in which we actually are intervening coercively because of judgments that people's mental illness actually impairs their ability to make judgments in their own best interest. We should nonetheless try to maximize choice even when we are being coercive. We should try to be fair. We should try to be respectful. So let me give a couple of indicators of why situations in which this is now not done, right? And this is, again, what gives rise to the idea that I want to stay away from the mental health system because it is coercive and intrusive and, indeed, oppressive to some people. So sometimes when a commitment process has begun, you expect, of course, that there's going to be some interaction, some negotiation, if you will, between the person who has mental health needs and whom other people think need to get help for their mental health needs, and you're trying to convince them that the better thing to do is to get help on their own. So you expect in that whole process that there's going to be some portion of people who are going to agree to get treatment voluntarily. And obviously we want to increase the degree to which that happens. But sometimes there's no meeting of the minds here, and you know, notwithstanding, you know, their resistance, the decision is made that we have got to intervene coercively. And that's when the law requires that there be a hearing. I mean, after all, this is a deprivation of liberty, and the law requires that there be a hearing before people's liberty are taken away. Now, I have to say, in too many situations, what happens in these hearings is that, you know, there'll be maybe a clinical witness that'll say, basically, this is, you know, what happened, or maybe a family member, that this is what happened, and this is, and then there'll be a number of reports, and the sitting judge will, you know, read the reports. And the patient, you know, may be given an opportunity to say something, but I think the entire context is, you know, this is just a rubber stamp proceeding after all, and they don't really feel that anyone really wants to hear what they have to say. Maybe quite often haven't even met with the attorney that's been appointed to represent them. And then they're committed. And, you know, the bottom line is that they actually, even though they've had symptoms of mental illness and they may need a coercive intervention, people know when they've been treated with respect, right? And in many of the situations, people are not treated with respect and they're not really given an opportunity to be heard. So the very essence of due process is being given an opportunity to be heard. Now, let me just give you some research evidence about this. So I think Greg mentioned the MacArthur Foundation work that we've done. One of the things was the study of coercion. And, you know, obviously what we're trying to do is design systems that use coercion as little as possible, but when it is necessary, to do it in a way that actually promotes good outcomes. All right? So if we're thinking about good outcomes when we're using coercion, what you want to do is to minimize the aversive experience of coercion. Because if it's aversive, people are not going to do what I said, which is be engaged in the system, you know. So what you find out when you say, well, so who felt coerced? And we studied lots of people and we, you know, created instrumentation to measure the perceptions of coercion and how people felt about it. And what you basically find is that people feel less coerced, even though they've been ordered into treatment over their objection, that they feel less coerced and they're more likely to say thank you later. And Greg mentioned before that many people who are hospitalized do say thank you later. They're more likely to do that, substantially more likely, if they feel they've been fairly treated and they've been given an opportunity to be heard, right? So, you know, here is just one indication of the basic instinct, you know, that I'm, you know, that we're drawing on here, which is that even when we're using coercion, it is possible to do so with respect and to maximize people's choice. And so that even when people have been committed, and they need to, and they treatment is going to obviously be provided over their objection, and of course it can be in the hospital, and as we know, could be in the context of community treatment that they've been committed. You want to give them the maximum choice within those constraints over the type of treatment. You know, try to replicate what would happen if any of us was in mental health treatment at any given time, about, you know, what are the treatment options and what do you prefer, what are the side effects of this and the potential benefits of this. Just because we're using coercion doesn't mean that people shouldn't have an opportunity to play the maximum role, you know, in making those choices. Well, our system is not really designed to think this way quite often with committed patients. And so it's a way of trying to move, you know, in that direction by having this principle basically embedded in the law. Another important initiative in this way is to actually extend the concept of advanced directives, which we all know has been pretty fully developed in the context of end-of-life care, you know, where people know that they're, well, they might lose capacity at the end of life and have other people make decisions. Well, people who have had mental health experiences, mental health problems, know sometimes that they lose the ability to make decisions in their own best interests. They've had the experience, unlike at the end of life. You can, in these situations, you know, people actually have had the experience, they know what it's like, and they might be able to make judgments about what should happen if I should be in this situation again. So we are trying to extend the concept of advanced directives into mental health care because, again, it's a way of saying people should be empowered to make the choices to the maximum extent consistent with their own safety and the safety of others, to make choices even when they're having mental health crises. And maybe they can do that in advance by saying, you know, what they would like to have happen, what they don't like in particular, but also the kinds of things that they prefer. Treatment has to be ordered, you know, later on. And if they can control that in advance, obviously it reduces the need, for coercion later on. Okay, so these, in terms of the blueprint for the law, so these are some of the principles that are trying that we are relying on. The current situation then is that we've got these two challenges. We have to do something to strengthen our investment in mental health services, and we need to develop a legal structure that implements the principles that I've just described. I want to say some words about the two contexts that are raised here and that we're talking about and that obviously we're also problematic, apparently, in the case of Mr. Joe at Virginia Tech. And one is in the college mental health environment and the other is in the context of public mental health services. So with regard to the colleges, we've heard that we need to make services more accessible in the context of increasing demand or need for services and unfortunately reducing supply or at least a supply of services that's not keeping up and that creates these waiting lists and so on. We need to create an environment in which we promote health seeking. It's all the same things that I've just been saying about the larger community. We obviously need to do the same things within the colleges. So what do we do when students do not seek help? Okay, so what should school administrators do under these circumstances? And I think my read of the situation, and particularly in all the discussion that has come up after the Virginia Tech tragedy, is that colleges and university administrators are uncertain and maybe even ambivalent to a large extent about what their responsibilities are for assisting students with their mental health problems, you know, under circumstances that might require some more aggressive action. How aggressive should they be? And you know that in the aftermath of what happened on April the 16th, the question is being posed all over the country. So what did Virginia Tech do to get him help? Did they do enough? And the panel that was appointed by the governor is going to be looking into these questions, and I'm not going to try to comment on them, except to try to put it in this larger context. So another feature of this whole debate is people looking around for what went wrong and who to blame. Did they do enough? If they didn't do enough, why didn't they do enough? And at some point in this discussion, and it came up earlier today, some of the blame is being focused on the law, right? So if they didn't do enough, one of the reasons they didn't do enough is because the law is in the way. So does the law impede caring teachers and administrators from helping students in crisis? And there is certainly this story that it does. All right, so let's think about it a little bit. So what about these privacy restrictions? Is it the case that privacy laws, the Federal Educational Privacy Act, the federal regulation that governs healthcare privacy, so-called by the name HIPAA, or state law, state privacy laws, is it really the case that these laws prevent college administrators and teachers from communicating with each other, communicating with parents, for communicating concerns to mental health service providers, or indeed to campus law enforcement if concerns are there? And frankly, my read of the situation is that, you know, and I think Greg alluded to this, the problem is actually confusion about the law. It's not really the law in this situation. The law actually, the way I read it, authorizes and empowers college administrators and others to take action when they are concerned about the safety and health of the students or other people. There's an explicit exception, you know, in the federal law about this. And with regard to health records, that's related to educational records or information, but with regard to health records, HIPAA also has an equivalent exception in it. And all of this basically drives you to state law, and there may be some impediments in the law of various states, but there's not, the way I read it, any impediment under Virginia law to take actions if from a mental health, on a basis of mental health concerns, that you're concerned about the safety of the student or others. So I understand that there's concern about this, and always the possibility that, you know, that you could be sued for violating and infringing on patient privacy or on the privacy of your students. But I don't think there's any legal basis for this. Now, this can all probably be further clarified, but, you know, there's no problem in that way. Now, there's another set of problems, because it is said that the law is actually, apart from maybe the transfer of information, that the law is paralyzing the schools from taking more responsibility for intervening and for taking aggressive action when that might be indicated. Now, why would that be? Now, I think this point hasn't come up. So it is said that schools invite liability by taking aggressive action. On the one hand, if they take aggressive action based on mental health concerns for students who are resisting it, maybe make getting mental health counseling a condition of continued, you know, matriculation or requiring a medical leave with then some kind of leveraging effect on getting them treatment, that they will be violating the rights of the students under the Americans with Disabilities Act, because it would be a discrimination on the basis of their disability. On the other hand, they also may be worried that if they take steps to try to get students to take aggressive steps to facilitate treatment, that if tragedy occurs and they're unsuccessful and the student commits suicide or hurts someone else, that they're going to be sued because, having undertaken aggressive intervention, they failed to implement it effectively, and they're going to be liable for having contributed to the harm, after all, of a student that they knew was mentally ill and they didn't do everything that they should have done, potential tort liability. Right? So all of this, when you know, talk to people who are involved in this business, all of this seems like this constant threat of liability. Now, in this situation, you know, I have to say, this is a pretty sad commentary on our legal system. And maybe on the backbone of college administrators, if it is indeed leading college administrators not to take aggressive action in cases in which they think that students have mental health needs and that they need some help, right? That they're sitting on their hands, or they're putting their head in the sand, or worse, that they're saying, because they don't want to discriminate against the student, that we won't treat it as a mental health problem, we'll treat it as a discipline problem. And we will say an attempt to commit suicide is actually a cause for discipline, you know, under the university disciplinary system, and you can be kicked out of school for having, you know, attempted to commit suicide, which some schools have done, right? Now, this is perverse, right? To avoid liability for discriminating against a mentally ill person, you don't treat them as a mentally ill person, or you don't treat the mental illness, or you don't intervene in the mental illness, you punish them. Right. Now, fortunately, on this particular issue, to show you, I'm not making this up, I mean, maybe you haven't heard about this, but actually the Virginia General Assembly passed a bill prohibiting treating last term, you know, last session, prohibiting treating people, students who have mental health problems, particularly related to suicide, you know, as a basis for discipline, right? But it shows you what a peculiar situation now we are in. And indeed, in this situation, it does seem to me that we at least need to clarify what the authorities of colleges and universities are in this situation. My own judgment, frankly, is that they have ample authority now to do the right thing, including leveraged treatment. But maybe legislative attention is needed to make this, you know, even clearer than it now is. All right, now let me just say a few words about the public mental health services system. So with regard to the problem of access to services, we know, you read, I'm sure, that in December of 2005, because of concerns that had been raised by some of his classmates, female classmates, that they were being annoyed, maybe stalked by Mr. Joe. The campus police were called, and eventually, arising out of that process, when they decided not to press charges, but he made some suicidal, apparently, comments to roommates, that he was then taken, and a temporary detention order was filed to initiate a commitment process. And so it called attention, what happened. And so what happened in that particular case is he was, a commitment order was issued, he was ordered to participate in outpatient treatment in the court order. And from what we can gather, no follow-up was actually done to see whether he was actually participating in treatment. It certainly wasn't done by the Community Services Board. We know that. And maybe their expectation apparently was that it was going to be done by the College Health Service, but the College Health Service basically said, we don't do coerced treatment. So it probably wasn't done there either, although we don't know until the commission tells us what actually did happen. But at any rate, this whole episode called attention to many of the well-documented deficits, you know, in our community services system, and I'll just mention a couple of them. One I should mention, first of all, it turned out not to be a problem in this case, but it's a big problem, and it's one that Greg discussed with you earlier, which is at the time of a crisis intervention, an emergency intervention, if people need to be in a hospital or in some more intensive crisis stabilization, you know, program, and we need to fill in the gap in our services system with regard to alternatives to hospitalization and these intensive crisis stabilization programs, in order to be evaluated, right? In many, many situations around the state, including here, it takes a lot of time, and it's extremely inefficient and costly to look around and find a bed, okay, in a hospital or in a crisis stabilization program as they are put online. And so it does not provide timely access, and sometimes, in fact, people are actually let go because they can't find a bed for them. All right, now, what a horrible situation in terms of your commentary on our programs. Now, apparently that was not a problem in his case because they actually did have a bed immediately, but we shouldn't forget what is the common problem. What actually did occur in his case is that we see that there is a shortage of outpatient services, and as was mentioned earlier, the Inspector General did a report in the wake of the assist the Massengale Commission, the task force that's looking at the Virginia Tech incident, and found that there's a tremendous shortage of outpatient services in all the communities around the state, and the waiting list is 25 or 30 days. And it turns out that outpatient commitment is actually not very widely used in the state, and at least part of the reason, I think there are many reasons for this, but part of the reason is that actually the community services boards do not have the resources in order to be able to carry out these commitment orders. And of course, what would happen if you have a commitment order is anybody that's under a commitment order goes to the top of the line, right, and gets prioritized over many, many people who have been on the waiting list for a long time and so on. So there's a real problem of rationing if that were to happen. But also, they would have the responsibility for monitoring and supervising the person who needs intensive. If they were just, you know, committable, they need intensive outpatient services. You know, come back in a week and take a couple of aspirin isn't going to do the job, right? So they need intensive services, and that they just don't have the capacity to do that. Right, so that is an absolutely critical shortage in our system, and it's not only a shortage because we can't commit people to outpatient services. The real problem is that if we had better outpatient services available to people who need them when they need them, you could prevent crises, right? And even when they're having crises, if you can respond adequately to it before it spirals out of control, we can prevent the need for commitment, and we can prevent many of these problems, right? So the gap in services, you know, is a very, very serious problem for our whole system, as, you know, we have all repeatedly said. In addition, what happened highlighted the deficiencies in the law of commitment. And let me just tick those off. I'm probably running out of time here anyway. I guess I have. So one is, and I wanted to mention this because something that Greg said earlier, one of the problems that the Inspector General identified in the Cho case is the inadequate evaluation that was done before his commitment. Now, we do not know whether a more thorough evaluation at that time could have broken through the guardedness, you know, his guardedness with regard to, you know, the things, whatever they were in December of 2005 that were going on in his mind, you know, and he obviously wasn't being, you know, he wasn't volunteering information. So we don't know how much a more thorough evaluation at that time could have yielded. But what we do know is that there wasn't much of one that was done in terms of reaching out to various sources of information because it was just done too quickly. And this is no comment on the, you know, the nature, what people actually did and whether they carried out their responsibilities as they now are. But it happened in 24 hours, right, in a person that didn't have any history in the system and therefore that there was no record, right? So what the Inspector General said is if we are actually using the point of intervention in crisis as a basis for commitment in order to protect the interest of the individual in society, you have got to allow enough time to do an adequate evaluation before you turn this over to a judge to make a commitment decision. Right? Now, that's just common sense. So this is a broken part of our system, is that we do not have enough time to do an adequate evaluation. And I am reminded of Greg's example. Right? I mean, the train was moving toward discharge, right, for Mr. Jones. Right? And, you know, fortunately, you asked him the questions that you did, and you got some information that maybe other people hadn't gotten. But it just highlights the absolutely critical nature of the thoroughness of the evaluation that is conducted, you know, in these cases. And the outcome turns on it, and, you know, the stakes can be pretty high. And then finally, because it has received so much attention, there is the issue of these outpatient commitment orders. So they did make an outpatient commitment in this case. But there was no specificity in the court order about what the conditions of treatment were, right? Just said outpatient treatment, right? No specificity in the court order about who was supposed to do it, right? And whether there had been any protocol, you know, that existed prior to this about, you know, how these outpatient commitment orders were going to be implemented and who's going to be responsible for monitoring. There had been no protocol between, you know, that CSB and that special justice who was doing it. And I can guarantee you they're not all over the state. Right, because I've asked the people who have the best models for emergency services and the relationships with the courts, and they haven't made, you know, protocols to govern these cases. And it does turn out, based on the study that the commission just did, that only about 4% of all commitments actually result in, I think it's 6% of all commitments now are to outpatient treatment. It is just not very widely used. And as I say, you know, if it's going to be more widely used, and there probably is a case that can be made if you can put the services in place, that outpatient commitment might be an appropriate part of our community mental health system, you know, if you have the services in place. We've got to make the appropriate arrangements between the courts and the services system so that these orders can be monitored and carried out. And we need to designate who's going to be responsible, and we have to have better understanding of what the consequences of non-compliance are. I mean, this wasn't apparently monitored, so we didn't know about whether it was compliant. But even if you say, you know, we're going to monitor for non-compliance, well, what are you going to do when people do not comply? And right now, the law leaves that completely up in the air. It's just not clear what is supposed to happen. So the immediate challenge for our commission and then eventually for the General Assembly is to try to put in place the procedures and policies that will allow you to implement outpatient commitment, but only if the services are put in place before you try to do it. And right now we have that dual challenge. So that is a brief tour through the legal issues as I see them, and you probably don't have any time for discussion. But.
Let me invite questions to all three of our guests today. Allison, come on back up, and then we will close in a few minutes with a general question to all three of the panelists, asking them to prioritize what they think needs to be done to fix the problems they've identified. But let me ask Richard Bonney if he would start off by saying, if you could go before the General Assembly and ask for one piece of curative legislation during the upcoming session, would you be asking the Appropriations Committee for resources, or would you be asking for some change in the laws? And if so, what would that be?
Well, is this on? There's no doubt in my mind, if you could pick one thing, it would have to be resources. Right? That we can crank along with the law the way we are now, the highest priority has got to be to increase the investment in community services. I think over time, if that is all done, we would like to see a comprehensive reform of the commitment process with a redesign. But that's actually going to take our commission a bit longer, I think, to come up with. So that's an easy question, George.
This is for the whole panel. It's kind of strange to hear you all talk about this without talking about the society that this is all occurring in. And we talk about we the people. You've identified that the stigmatization is the biggest problem to get over to trying to get help and treatment for these people. My question is, can we afford to be we the people if you can walk across the street and buy a 9mm handgun? Would somebody address that?
Well, do you want to start with that one, Greg?
Since you're the legal scholar.
Well, you know, actually, I, just to be perfectly realistic about this, the unfinished business of deinstitutionalization and increasing our investments in community services and creating a humane and caring society in those ways, as daunting as that challenge is, I think it is less daunting than the challenge of trying to solve the problems of having 260 million firearms or whatever the number is, an open society. And it's just going to take decades and a change in our culture, actually, I think, to really come to terms with that. It's certainly understandable from a gun control standpoint to see that even if you can't substantially restrict the accessibility of firearms throughout the society, that we ought to try to reduce access to people that have documented, serious mental health problems that have led them to be a danger to themselves or others. It makes sort of common sense, to have that provision in the federal gun control laws and in state gun control laws, and to try to effectuate them. But I think we all actually know that, doing that in the context in which guns are so widely available actually is not going to make a substantial impact on the problem or in preventing these problems. It's, it's not even a Band-Aid, basically, and it, I think, does raise these concerns that what seems like a perfectly sensible and rational protective stance is actually a form of unwarranted discrimination. So it's it's a very, very complicated issue, and I do know that within the mental health world, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill and also the American Psychiatric Association have come down hard on the discriminatory, features of this, even though they recognize that the problem is much larger, because they say you really ought to solve the gun control problem in a much more global way, and so on. And, that's the parameters of the debate. I just think we have other things we need to worry about, on this. I will say one other thing. It does turn out that in a society, a state like Virginia, where the interest in owning and possessing firearms is regarded, as an important civil liberty, that the judges who are doing these hearings, many of them, are aware of that. And so what they are doing is using the possible loss of access to firearms as a point in the negotiation with patients who are subject to commitment to get them to get treatment voluntarily, right? Because if you don't, you're going to end up in this data system. And, again, that's another distortion, that we do want to promote voluntariness. But if we're trying to solve the gun control problems by keeping guns out of the hands of the mentally ill, this system that's been created to do that has virtually no chance of working successfully.
Could you give us a picture of the UVA treatment possibilities for students? Do we have a chapter of your group, Allison? How many counselors are available, et cetera?
Goes to really both Allison and Greg, I guess.
There is a chapter of Active Minds here at UVA. So they are a group of students working with the counseling center, and I'm remiss. There was somebody from the counseling center here, but I think he just left. So I don't know, Greg, if you have any more information.
Well, I will say that over the years, there really has been an increasing understanding of the need for treatment of students who have more significant mental illness. And so the university has ramped up its ability to diagnose and treat and assess those students. So the university does take this seriously. I think we still are, like many other universities, playing catch-up in terms of adapting to some real changes in the society that have just occurred over the last few years. But there is a real interest in this, obviously, and actually had been prior to the Virginia Tech shootings. And I would like to also mention that the commission that Richard is chairing was actually formed prior to this April 16th event. As many of you probably know, Chief Justice Hassell decided that this was an issue that was significant enough to form the commission, and I think it's heartening that leadership within the state has recognized that it didn't take a tragedy like this to form a commission, and that Richard and his group have been working at this now for a number of months.
The Miller Center of Public Affairs takes pride in being able to foster a dialogue on important national issues. And I want to thank for participating in at least getting the dialogue started. Allison Malman, Richard Bonney, and Greg Satoff. Thank you.